another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. Last night, I gave a talk for the Consciousness Hacking Group in San Francisco. Consciousness Hacking is a group, started 3 or 4 years ago by Mikey Siegel and some friends, and we've had Mikey on the Expanding Mind podcast before. And these are folks, mostly younger folks, who are interested in bringing together technology and science with consciousness exploration and spiritual transformation, goals of spiritual transformation. And what I decided to do for the talk is to talk about the 1970s, which is something I've been working on and studying and writing about for a while now. But I was really interested, I realized, in kind of tracing a certain way of looking at the explosion of altered states and consciousness explorations that began, in earnest in the 1960s, of course, drawing from many people and scenes that have existed for millennia, but in our modern world really kind of exploded in the late 60s and then transformed in the 1970s. But rather than looking at it as kind of a revival of religion, which is in some ways accurate, you know, you had all the gurus in the 70s and now we have all the shamans of today. You know, we keep returning to these kind of religious frameworks as we explore the outer zones of consciousness. But I realized I was kind of more interested in tracking another way, which is a sort of way of moving through these spaces of spiritual traditions, of practices, meditation, yoga, psychedelics, exploring religious traditions, iconography, etc., but doing it in a kind of spirit of open-minded, ongoing, critically aware exploration rather than the kind of more quote-unquote religious approach of finding a truth, finding a particular belief structure, a dogma, an authoritarian teacher. And it seems to me that a lot of what we've been doing with this whole evolving spirit since that time, although there's many, many precedents, is really kind of creating a new way. I mean, some people like to call it like spiritual but not religious. I have a lot of kind of problems with that phrase, which is also just sort of ugly, but it does point to something distinct that though religion and broadly taken is part of this practice, part of this path, it sort of goes in a different direction. And so I've been very interested lately in thinking more about people and practitioners and practice traditions and groups and scenes that have tried to that want to bring that spirit forward, where there's sort of a deep respect and relationship with more traditional currents of religion or spiritual life, but are also doing it in kind of a little bit more of a modern framework, maybe more open-minded, more critical, more grounded in politics and science, but also more open in a way to the multiple possibilities of experience, and are willing to question a lot of the kind of hackneyed chestnuts that come along for the ride with spirituality, like, oh, it's all about unity, or, you know, you have to anger is the worst thing in the world, you have to become pure, or whatever. A lot of these sort of ideas that go with the territory deserve to be questioned and turned upside down and turned inside out. And one of the figures that I've been wanting to talk to for a long time, and I'm very happy that he decided to join me today, is Ganga White, not only because he's had a remarkable history of really being at the forefront of some of the changes and explorations that I've already talked about. He opened the yoga center on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles in 1967 and was really instrumental in helping to build what we think of as kind of modern American yoga, the coming out of the counterculture and then achieving, you know, a great deal of success. He's had a remarkable career Within yoga, writing yoga, coming up with new styles, helping to develop styles of yoga that are now, you know, widely practiced throughout the world. He was also at the forefront of the turn towards ayahuasca. He was at the first big ayahuasca conference in the early 1990s, and has not only, you know, explored that in tandem with his a practice of yoga and meditation and his absorption of Eastern teachings and Western teachings, but has thought very deeply about it. And in fact, he wrote I get the MAPS journal, probably like a lot of you folks out there, the Multiple Disciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. And he wrote, I think, my favorite piece that I've ever seen in MAPS, or at least the one that I agreed with the most. He was talking about yoga and psychedelics and how to think about that, and he does that in ways that very much resonate with the kind of openness that I was talking about earlier in my little spiel here. So I'm very happy that Ganga Weitz decides to join us today. And so, with no further ado, Ganga, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's a privilege and an honor. And that was a great introduction. I don't mean about me, but about everything you said about philosophy and religion and spirituality. That pretty much sums up a lot. Beautiful.
Yeah, I know. I mean, as I said, I knew about you and I'd read interviews or things like that. But when I came across that MAPS piece, I was like, oh yeah, this guy is on it. You know, this is something we really have to kind of bring forward. And in a lot of ways, that's why I wanted to talk to you. And I think one of the ways of approaching that is talking about your life, your history, your experience with this, particularly, you know, early on. And just thinking about, like, when you opened that studio in 1967, what did it mean to be doing, to be practicing yoga? What did it mean to be, you know, a Californian opening a yoga studio at that time and in that place? I mean, particularly in light of all that yoga has become since then, when you look back at that time, what was different? What was fresh? What was obscured in that sort of first wave that you participated in of that kind of countercultural yoga moment?
Yeah, that was definitely a very different time and a big wave. And people didn't have a lot of knowledge or understanding of yoga. I used to get teased on interviews about, are you into yogurt or yoga? I mean, that's how simplistic the thoughts were. There was a lot of interest, a lot of young people coming up, but, you know, we also had to kind of promote it and give lectures and demonstrations to get people interested, and people were saying, well, why don't I just jog? Why do I, you know, do all these crazy positions and sit on the floor? What's involved in that? And we had to give them answers and reasons about, you know, balancing your whole body and joints and flexibility and strength and all sorts of things, which we also learned as we went along. So it was a different time and an exciting time.
So were the people who were coming in those years, the late 60s, early 70s, as Yoga Center grew, were they approaching it? What was the balance of physical healing versus spiritual pursuit? I mean, that's one of the remarkable things about yoga, especially as you look at it now, as the way it is practiced now, where you have this thing that has, like, almost entirely subsumed one into the other. Like, you can't really extricate them. Like, the physical practice, the way in which people treat it as a you know, like going to the gym, except better. They're doing it to have better abs or tighter butts or whatever it is, and then it's right side by side with the language of chakras, of energy, of healing, of insight, and you can't even really distinguish it in a lot of classes. It's like one thing. In that time, how was that balance different, or was it different in terms of the motivations and the forms that it took?
I think the original impetus with people getting into yoga was spiritual and metaphysical, mystic. People were coming out of, or were in, the, you know, amazing 60s and all the experiences people were having. And personally, I had no idea that there was a physical component. but I wanted to learn yoga, and I felt that, you know, a lot of the experiences, mystical experiences I was having would be explained by the masters of the East had figured this out. And so I sought it out. And then one of the first teachers I went to was actually a professor of comparative religion, Dr. Framrose Bode. And he was giving lecture. He was giving a course on Eastern religions just by lectures twice a week. And the first one I went to was on yoga. And it was on, you know, like philosophical or spiritual yoga. And I kept hounding him for more information on it. And finally, he gave me a brochure that had all these asanas in it. And I said, what's that got to do with it? And he said, oh, you know, body, mind, and spirit and all this, and you should check it out. So it seemed unusual, or, you know, I couldn't explain that connection at first. So, yeah, I would say a lot of people's drive was, you know, understanding consciousness, the mind, spirituality, and those arenas. And the physical kind of, it came on very fast, though. Everybody got into it.
Yeah, well, understandably, it's a pretty powerful and pretty fun practice in a lot of ways. One thing that interests me about that period in your life is that, you know, because you were pursuing it as a spiritual practice and you were interested in meditation and yoga philosophy as well as the physical practice, or bringing those things together, you know, you got into the Shivananda scene, and I would love to hear a little bit about what the Shivananda yoga world was like. But particularly what interests me is that point, I think, in the early 70s, where even though you were rising in the ranks, you know, you must have been, you know, gaining more status and people are interested in these things, and you're, you know, you're getting a sense of like moving forward in this particular tradition, you decide to step away from the whole that yoga ashram world, and partly out of the desire to kind of step away from a more traditional structure of schools and authority. And I'd love to hear how that worked for you. Like, what was appealing at first about a more traditional kind of school structure? And then what happened in you to make you go, you know what, I need to go another way. I need to do something that's more open-ended or exploratory or more individual, less authoritarian or whatever it is. I would really love to hear how you went through that process and came out the other side.
Certainly, I'll see if I can elucidate it. And we can come back to, you know, the mystical and the psychedelic and all that. So I was really into, you know, the rebellious 60s and questioning authority, and the exploration of the East was that. It was like, wait a minute, we have our Judeo-Christian religious thing here, and it's the supreme teaching, and so that was already moving really out of the box. And I had no idea that, like I said, that there was a physical practice. So I started going to talks and whatnot, and one of these early professors gave me this brochure, and that attracted me to the Shivananda. So I went in there kind of like with full faith and feeling that, you know, these teachers really had the answers and the path to what full awakening and self knowledge. And so I started practicing really diligently, asanas, you know, hour and a half, 2 hours twice a day, and meditation and study and service work and all this stuff. And slowly over a period of time, within, you know, I rose up in the ranks of the organization, and within, you know, getting to know a lot of the leaders and founders and everything on a personal basis and hosting them at our center and home and so on, I started seeing that, you know, they were had as many problems and difficulties and psychological things they didn't work through as we did, and often even more. So it was really a shock, and it really happened all at once, this kind of snapping back to my questioning, exploring self. Was I was living in an ashram, and the head guru there was on a phone extension listening to his secretary, a woman, having a conversation with a bill collector because he never paid his bills. And she was talking, and he was getting madder and madder. And then he started yelling through the phone. And then she was in another cottage, and he ran over there, and I followed him to see what was going on. And he was in there slapping her and hitting her. And right in that moment, it was like an awakening. It's like, wait a minute, I've got to start questioning everything again. Something is really wrong with this picture.
Well, what I love about that story is the way you use the word awakening. You know, we think of awakening as being, oh, this is something that comes with spiritual practice. You know, you're deep in your, you know, the third hour of your meditation, and you finally have a moment of awakening. But there are these other awakenings that are just as profound. And in fact, in some ways, it's part of the same awakening. You know, it's that disenchantment is often as much a part of awakening as the sort of revelation of a new vision or a new sort of juicy metaphysical reality. But in some ways, it's part of the same process. I mean, awakening is awakening in all these different dimensions, not just the one that we fantasize about.
Yeah, there are many dimensions. And I, you know, what I've come to is the greatest teacher is life. And if we look at our lives and any growth or wisdom and insight that we've got so far, much of it came from difficult experiences. Some of the biggest challenges are the greatest awakenings and revelations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a way that also kind of brings up some of the issues with psychedelics or entheogens is that they can be you know, incredibly harrowing, and that is part of the path there too, is that there are experiences you go through that are very difficult, and yet with the proper structure, the proper intention, and sometimes even not, that those things can be incredibly valuable. I'm curious whether for you, since you came, you know, you came from the 60s generation, you were definitely interested in, you know, the psychedelic Tibetan Book of the Dead and that whole kind of mixture of psychedelics and spirituality that was such a big part of that moment. Did you kind of maintain a relationship with that zone throughout the 70s and 80s? I mean, I know that you started becoming more interested in ayahuasca later on. But was that always something that you kind of kept a relationship with, or did it sort of go away for a while and then return?
The latter. I, you know, had these powerful, as I mentioned, spiritual and mystical and psychedelic experiences, and then I sought out answers in the Eastern traditions, and they almost unanimously said, no, these experiences you had are not the real thing, and the real thing comes from years of practice and meditation and repeating mantras and so on, and you really have to apply yourself, and then you'll get there naturally, and then you'll become established in that. And so I started totally applying myself, and literally we had to give up everything, tea, coffee, even aspirin only in a, you know, if you really had a horrible headache because you didn't want to mess with your astral body and, you know, put these toxins and impure things in your body. So we, you know, I went through about 4 or 5 years of that until I got snapped out of it again and started realizing that those experiences I had were real and were powerful. And that's where I stand since then.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that a little bit more. I mean, that was one of the things that struck me about the piece in MAPS, in the MAPS journal, was just a certain way of, If you are a spiritual practitioner and you take spiritual experiences seriously, meaning you recognize that these things can happen to you, change your life, open, you know, shift the plane, that it's valuable, it's worthwhile to pursue them with meditation or yoga or other practices of prayer and engaging with some traditional forms, then there's this sort of question of like psychedelics, which seem to, certainly for many people, seem to produce things that look a lot like spiritual experience, and some people will say aren't, but other people go, well, what's the difference? Let's just work with them. But what is the difference? I mean, as someone who Or is there? Is there one at all? Is it just another way that one can have experiences which initiate one into a different way of being or seeing the world? But is there also still a kind of something that separates psychedelics from more traditional spiritual paths and practices in your experience?
I've come to almost the reverse. So I'll preface it by saying that, you know, the Good Friday experiment, I'm sure you've probably heard of it, where they took, I think it was 40 religious people who had practiced and from many disciplines, priests and monks and Zen and Buddhists and yogis and so on, but who had had zero experience at all with substances. And they, you know, these people all volunteered to do a strong dose of sacred mushrooms. I think it was 4 or 5 grams. And I think 39 of them had the most powerful spiritual religious experience of their lives. And they followed up with them years later. And they stood by that and said it had changed and informed their life, and it was the most important thing that had ever happened to them. And if you take 40 people that practice their meditation every day, you know, years later, you might have one or two, if you're lucky, that have that level of an experience. So, and there's more and more evidence all the time that is actually showing that psychotropic plants and teachers have had a place back thousands of years, and even at the original impulse and beginning of Christianity, that it was part of it. And it certainly goes back in the Indian tradition with Soma, and even cannabis that has been used for thousands of years. And we have pathways in our brain and receptors and conductor sites that open up. Modern research is showing that and confirming that in many ways. So it's not only that these experiences are authentic, but they are some of the most potent and original religious experiences that are available to us.
Yeah, I mean, some people even think that if you go back and look at cave art, the sort of earliest marks that human beings make as sort of art-making, culture-making creatures, that some of the patterns and particularly the abstract designs that accompany a lot of these images could well be the sort of record of trance states, including ones that, of course, would be, you know, could be had through psychedelics. We don't know what they were doing, but there's certainly the sense that, like, that trance dimension is one of our, you know, fundamental birthrights as human beings. And I think that what we're seeing now with, you know, just the extraordinary kind of popularity of ayahuasca, which still blows my mind. I mean, I've been thinking about this stuff forever. Like, you know, my whole life I've been interested in psychedelics and modern culture and tracking these things out of, you know, all these kind of underground subcultures and how they influence the larger mainstream discourse and images, blah, 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 blah. And I'm still blown away by how mainstream ayahuasca use has become, because it's, you know, it's even with, you know, even among hardcore psychonauts, I mean, it's no joke. You know, it's a very intense, unpredictable in some ways, and potentially harrowing as well as, you know, incredibly healing, whatever that exactly means, the word healing. It's easy to throw around, but certainly a very a juicy route towards precisely these kinds of higher insights and states of tremendous spiritual bliss and ecstasy and insight that we've been talking about. But it still blows my mind how mainstream it's become, and it's got to be because there's some part of just human being that is like, we all deserve our own individual access route to that trance realm, and if you press it out of people, it's gonna pop back in some kind of way. That's my attempt to understand it. I don't know, what do you think? I mean, you've been tracking this thing for what, over 25 years of you know, experiencing ayahuasca, getting into it, checking it out, seeing how it affects 50 people.
Years. I'm getting up there. I just turned 70 recently, and it all started with this. You know, I was going to college studying electronic engineering and super interested I have a, pretty strong background in science. And, it just, my good fortune of being around Southern California where so many things happened first. And first thing that happened was somebody turned me on to cannabis, and I had heard it was such a horrible narcotic drug and realized instantly it wasn't, and it had a lot of, positive uses. And then shortly thereafter, I was working in an electronics store, and there was a gay guy who was repairman, and the guy was a wizard. He could fix anything. And slowly as we got to become friends, gays weren't out of the closet then, so he, told me he was gay, and we became, great friends. And he eventually invited me over with his partner, and they turned me on to an LSD experience. And it totally transformed my life in 2 weekends and put me on this, spiritual path. And looking back into that, I was interested in all this stuff before, which is why I was so willing to do it, and I was always questioning, but that just opened all the doors of perception, you could say, and, had a really powerful experience. And in terms of the place of these things have sacred plants and mushrooms used properly, you could say, it actually, like I mentioned, it actually goes back thousands of years, and it's just been, in my opinion, all but proven that it was a big part of the origins even of Christianity. So there's another lucky thing that two authors of a new book called The Psychedelic Gospels, it just came out a few weeks ago, which they started finding art and iconography, like you mentioned, going way back, caves and whatnot, but all through early Christianity. Like when you look at some of the paintings of the Last Supper, they all have drawings of mushrooms on their bottom of their robes. And then it seems to be they're involved with Amanita muscaria and psilocybin mushrooms, because you can literally identify them from some of the iconography. And I think this book, which is just hitting the circuits, is going to make a lot of waves, and it'll certainly be controversial for some people, but I think they make a pretty powerful argument. And they're professors of anthropology teaching PhD students, so they're no slouch scholars. It's a pretty powerful argument.
Yeah, that kind of evidence or arguments have been building for a while. I'm familiar with that book. I haven't taken a look at it yet, but it certainly seems that there's again a kind of sense of reclaiming a birthright, if you will, in terms of the how primordial these things have been in human culture and experience. But then, of course, we're also doing it in our terribly modern way. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is just, and we could talk about yoga, or we could talk about psychedelics, particularly ayahuasca. You were part of this sort of movement. Let's just stay with yoga for the moment, and you saw this, you saw it build up. You were successful in it. You had, best-selling videos and books, and you developed centers I think the yoga center eventually transformed after you let go of it into Yoga Works, which is now like this kind of, octopus, took over my studio, which is fine. It's been great. They do seem to do a good job, but it's definitely like, yoga meets capitalism in this way. And now it's just so huge. It's become such a mainstream part of America. How do you feel about that? I mean, you're a critical thinker. Is there a dark side of it that you see? Are there problems that you think that the contemporary yoga scene has gotten itself into that it would be good to look at different sources or have a different approach? Or do you feel really good about how many people are now being able to access these wonderful practices?
Well, I'll give you a little analogy. Back in the 60s, we were all, sincerely practicing yoga and meditation and postures. And then Hittleman came out with a show on television. And we all just reacted to this guy commercializing the whole thing. And how come he thinks he knows anything? Turns out he did know a fair amount. But anyway, we got off it and thought, well, God, it's getting on television. It's getting the word out there. And you could certainly make the argument that, maybe some people will get turned off because it isn't as deep as personal contact or a class, but it helped spread yoga and did a lot of positive things. So hopefully all this commercialization and, franchising and all that YogaWorks is doing, and by the way, I didn't sell to YogaWorks. We created the Center for Yoga in Los Angeles, and it was the first center of that sort of eclectic type with many, many different approaches and explorations going on. And I eventually, to start our yoga retreat in Santa Barbara, I didn't want to have to have too much, business management down there too, running back and forth. So we sold it to the director, and then he sold it later, and it eventually was sold to YogaWorks, who used it to pattern all their centers after. And, there's a certain loss you can see when, they're franchising and you have to follow a certain formula and it loses a certain kind of aliveness and spontaneity of teachers. But, I don't know if I totally have an opinion. Maybe in the greater scheme of things, you can always make the argument on the other hand, like the two sages who are debating, and no matter what one said, the other one said, well, on the other hand, this could happen, and that, you can't see where it's all going.
Yeah, it's very, I find it endlessly fascinating, and it's like, every time I go to a practice, it's like, in addition to whatever is happening with my own body and my own heart, and my own, my own practice, I have this like ongoing anthropological study of how these things have changed, because the studio near me where I live in San Francisco, Yoga Tree, like it opened its first branch, like a couple blocks from my place in, I think in the late 90s. And we started going like right off the bat. So we were able to kind of ride and watch the evolution of that particular center as it became its own kind of, very successful operation with multiple centers, et cetera. And then just also the way that the teachers would change and become popular and how they would shift and how social media enters in. I mean, it's been like completely fascinating, particularly because it exists in such a curious juncture between, physical health and the desire for a beautiful body and the sort of, erotic drive to get juicy with your physical experience in the world. And then all these different versions of spirituality that different teachers bring, the kind of self-help stuff or more, well-informed kind of tantric physiology. I remember one story, it was early on, it was Rusty Wells was the teacher, and I came out of a back bend, and I got this like super psychedelic head rush, like it was like really trippy for 30 seconds or 45 seconds, something like that. It was fine. I wasn't like keeling over or passing out. So after the class, I went up to him and I go, "So I had this experience. What was it?" And he goes, "Well, the blood rushing, and we got to watch it because the physiology of the, blood rushing through the, I don't remember exactly what he said." And I said, "Well, I know what you're talking about, but this was more, well, like, have you done nitrous oxide?" And he went, "Oh, well, actually there are these nadis." And he switched his language from this physiological language to this tantric esoteric energy language of nadis and chakras as my experience kind of warranted it. And it always stuck with me as this like beautiful summation of the way in which yoga has become a place that people with a great deal of knowledge and intentionality, and sometimes not so much knowledge and not so much intentionality, are like working this ongoing tension between scientific, you know, more or less physical accounts of reality and this metaphysical, mystical, visionary realm that will never become one exactly, but yet we're always building bridges between them.
I think that brings up a really important point, is that we tend to always want to what I call mechanize teachings. And when people say yoga is scientific. So, you know, science is certainly the essence of it is questioning and changing and evolving, but science also sort of implies to people a structured practice or process. So you have, you know, people saying this is the sequence you must do, like Bikram says, and this will cure every ailment on the planet, and you have to follow this exact sequence every day, and those things are like snake oil. That we think that there's going to be a recipe or a formula, and we just follow that. And I think awakening and spirituality and insight and love cannot be mechanized. They're spontaneous. You can't explain them because they're bigger than us. So we like to emphasize that practices are important, and even learning some structured practices are important. But also, you have to give equal energy to your process and to letting things unfold and to awakening your insight and intuition. And you can even apply that to a physical asana because, you know, you can take five people with low back pain and, you know, there are formulas in books and they can be helpful to try and figure out what to do. But, one of them forward bends will help them, and the other one forward bends will aggravate it, and twists will help one and aggravate another person. So you always have to have a softening of your formulas and recipes and just listen to the effects of what you're doing and watch the feedback and be guided from within and from without into rebalancing yourself and healing yourself or reaching a new level of strength, flexibility, and endurance.
Yeah, absolutely. I got a question for you kind of along those lines, is that, you know, like in your own life, you started out with this kind of openness, psychedelics, turning on to spirituality, finding teachers, students, and then you went through a period of much more rigorous devotion and commitment to a particular set of practices, a particular institution, a set of teachers who were part of that, and you were willing to discipline yourself and to, you know, not take the aspirin, whatever. Go down this kind of, in a way, narrowing of discipline until you reach a point where you're like, whoa, this isn't working anymore. There's some serious hypocrisy here. This whole structure maybe isn't appropriate for where we are in history, or at least for me. And you kind of move on and then have a more inventive, open-ended way of addressing these things. Do you think it's necessary for people to do that? And if it is the case that it's necessary, it puts us kind of in a bind, because you kind of need there to be hard-ass true believers to do the work to maintain the disciplinary structures that then you can like learn from on your way towards a more open-ended, experimental, exploratory way of being in the world. Or not? I don't know. I had the same thing. I went through a Zen period that was very focused, and I did very intense reading, and I did a lot of session, and I did a lot of. I mean, I still have a daily meditation practice, but I did it in a certain kind of way. And then at a certain point, I had a very clear, like, just it was like kind of what you described. It was this one day where I had an insight into a kind of fault in the structure, and I just was immediately released from it. And I haven't really been participating in a group like that since. But I wonder about that. It's like we need people to kind of keep like the sort of more traditionalist thing down, because it can be very useful to spend some time there, especially early on in your practice.
Well, the people who are advocating fixed approaches or have a particular practice or lineage, they think you have to go through that to attain freedom, and it's a stepping stone. And that's, you know, that perspective has been an ongoing debate with people like me who don't think so. So, yeah, my answer is you don't have to, but also there's no path. So everybody does what they do, and that becomes their path. And I certainly wouldn't want to be without all those rigid times because they were a big part of my awakening. But I've seen many people just totally bypass all that by seeing it. You could almost say in a similar way that, you know, if you see somebody being an alcoholic, that doesn't mean you have to go through it so that you can transcend it. So with
good
perception and observation, you can learn from others. That's how humanity also evolves. We don't have to go through everything all over again. And so I don't think there's any fixed path. But that doesn't mean you don't use structured practices. I use them sometimes, but I'm not what I'd call stuck in them.
That makes sense. It makes sense even with yoga. I had a wonderful experience. I went to a meditation retreat recently, and I didn't realize they had a yoga room. And at the very end of the week, I was kind of stiff, and I hadn't done any physical stretching, really. I'd done hikes, but I hadn't really stretched. And so, oh, my God, there's a yoga room. So I went in there, and it was amazing. It's like I have a lot of trouble doing my own practice at home. It like always just becomes kind of peters out, and I end up just sort of stretching. Like I really need the structure of a lead class to kind of get to the edge for me usually. But this one time, because I was so centered in my meditation practice, all of the moves unfolded like perfectly naturally. I didn't have to make any decisions. I just did like a perfect, you know, 25 minute little set of things, and some of them were poses and some of them were just what I was doing at the time. And it was really amazing because I usually have difficulty getting that degree of sort of spontaneous, appropriate expression. But now I know it can be done.
Yeah, that's exactly what we call intuitive flow. So, you know, what we teach is there's two dimensions of practice. There's one where you follow a form, and there's benefits to following a form or taking a class from somebody else that are unique, and that's the only way to get that. But similarly, there's some very unique things from practicing guided from within, with your learning to develop your own intuitive flow. And you don't need to, or you shouldn't have a fixed idea that it needs to be an hour or 20 minutes or an hour and a half. You don't know. Your body's going to tell you what it needs. And it doesn't take long for that ability to really develop. It's similar to where you get up in the morning and you just feel a little tight and you just kind of stretch around and you bend and move your arms and twist your neck. And you're not doing that by a form and saying, okay, turn my head 1 inch to the left. Now pull my shoulder back while I stick my opposite arm out. You're just guided from within. You feel the movement. And that's how you develop an intuitive flow practice, and you wouldn't want to be without it. It's incredibly powerful and healing, and it's in its own dimension of practice.
Well, you mentioned the word flow, and of course, one of the things that you're known for is helping to develop the whole idea of flow yoga in the 70s, and that really has become one of the kind of baselines. People don't even recognize that it's a particular style almost. It's just the way you do yoga. Talk about that shift. Like, how did you discover that? What were the principles that you wanted to bring forward with the emphasis on flow? And why do you think it was so successful?
Well, I discovered it, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, but back in the early days while I was still with Shivananda, and certainly we did a sequence. But the poses were all kind of thrown together, and you do one pose, and they had the idea that you had to rest and relax in between each pose. I would sometimes put on music at night in my living room, and I'd just start doing postures to the music and moving from pose to pose, which doesn't mean not holding it. You know, I might hold a pose for a while and then change and flow into another, and I just started calling it flow yoga, and then I started teaching it, and people really responded to it, and we developed it over the years, and also expanded our definition of flow. So flow, just like a river, can, you know, it has rapids, it has stills, it even has eddies that are flowing the opposite direction, it has lakes. So a flow practice can be dynamic, it can be intense and vigorous, it can be very restorative and healing and soft. It can be long holding or a mixture of these different things. So there are many different ways you can learn to just develop a flow, that not just a flow of movement, but that flows with your breath and that flows with your concentration and meditation right within the same practice, and it becomes like a spiritual dance of wellness and healing. And I think it's one of the great ways of practicing, and it's spread all around the world, and we've certainly trained a lot of teachers in that and taught it all over the world. But I also think that, you know, it was something waiting to be discovered, and I'm sure other people came upon it too.
Well, I love the way that hearing you talk about it, because then I can hear the sort of inner, almost esoteric encouragement in it towards allowing yourself, just in your own practice, to find, work your way into, and then become this kind of flow, a flow that isn't just about keeping a certain intensity going, but is also open to slowing down, to stasis, to, you know, whirlpools, to lakes. All that was it kind of gave another dimension to it, because it's just so easy in a way to avoid kind of taking the responsibility or encouraging yourself to develop the intuition that's necessary to do those things inside of practice. For me, when you describe those things, it reminds me much more of my own meditation practice, which has been largely, with the exception of following my breath when my mind's scattered, is basically just non-formal. And I've been doing it forever. So I have this very particular way that I meditate that I never know where we're going to go. And, you know, and it's funny because so many people who are into meditation, they're so into their form. They're so into the practice they're doing. They're doing this thing and they're, you know, doing this and moving their energy here. They're counting or they're following or they're doing mindfulness and this and that and da-da-da. And, I read those. I'm familiar with them. But for me, it's been much more the way that you describe this kind of flow.
Yeah, and that's from day to day. Some people say you have to practice every day or 6 days a week, but who says so? You want to listen to your own body, your own feedback, your own flow, and sometimes days off are a part of that flow, and they just happen. And, you know, we live in this huge polarized, you know, universe between energy and matter, and between form and formless, and structured and unstructured, and that which can be explained and that which can't be explained, and the measurable and the immeasurable, and the, you know, the ends of that poles are endless, and they both are relevant. It's like you touched on earlier. People say the only truth is unity and oneness, and we're all one. But you can also, you know, when you're in the oneness experience, and if you're lucky enough to have a mystical experience like that, diversity seems an illusion. But from the perspective of diversity in which we live, the oneness is an idea and can seem like an illusion. And I think the truth is that they're embedded in each other. You can't have the one without the many, and you can't have the many without the one. So just like you can't have energy without matter, even though energy and matter are the same. Matter is condensed energy being reflected back. So for me, science and spirituality are really the same laws and the same teaching. If we don't have a lot of dogma and crazy beliefs that are clouding that perception.
Yeah, I think one of the ways of talking about that move is that you take some of the kind of critical thinking or the willingness to engage explanations, good explanations that you have in science, and you take those with you into these more amorphous realms, more measureless realms. And it's not that it turns out that spirituality is actually just science after all, and that there's some kind of particular way of explaining all these things, or we can reduce them to some fact of the nervous system, yada, yada. But there's something else that happens when you bring certain elements of a more critical scientific view into those measureless realms that's really special. And that's sort of partly what I've, you know, what I've been interested in trying to talk about, and what I hear reflected in a lot of what you say that I find inspiring. I did want to give one shout out. We have about 7 minutes left. Earlier you mentioned the strong teaching that there is no path, and it's a beautiful, bracing, sometimes bitter, but in some ways incredibly sweet message. And of course, when you said that, I hear an echo of one of your great teachers, Krishnamurti, who was also, you know, the great California saint. And I think that his particular message was particularly appropriate for the exploratory West Coast, carnival that, you know, that you were participated in, that I grew up in a different era. Could you just say a few words about Krishnamurti and what was important about his teaching, and how that influenced your own perspective?
Well, his teachings, he was, you know, hailed as the Messiah, and then he renounced the role and walked out with an incredibly beautiful speech, and went on teaching people how to be unconditioned and free. And he talked about freedom and insight and the beauty and power of nature as one of the greatest teachers. And he was incredibly poetic and eloquent. He was very charismatic in person. I had a chance to meet him a few times, but when he gave his talks on stage, he was kind of aloof, and, you know, to me it was like he was scolding children for destroying the house they live in, our world. But he would save his most elevated talks to the last. And I found him really inspiring, and he taught how to question authority and realize that your beliefs are someone else's ideas, and you really don't know the truth until you see it for yourself. And that's only possible when you let go of your beliefs and what everybody else told you, and you're willing to stand psychologically naked. And I thought that was really profound, and I was glad he came through Ojai a lot, but I actually heard him in India and Europe and Switzerland and quite a number of places. It was quite a phenomenon to behold. He was kind of like a modern-day Buddha, and so he was, was great, one of the great teachers I had a chance.
Yeah, he could be a scold. That was well put.
Yeah, he could. He used to say there's no path to truth, and he was one of the first people who said that. But then he said, you have to find the sacred, and how you find it, I mean, he didn't say it this way, but that's your path, and no one's going to follow that exactly. So he talked about something, and he pointed towards it, but he wouldn't overly describe it, because he said then you just create an idea and a projection, which is what all the religions are trying to do, and follow a belief system. And he said you have to deprogram yourself. That's one of the greatest goals of living.
About a decade ago, you wrote or published a book, Yoga Beyond Belief, where you talk not only about yoga practice, but you sort of talk some about psychedelics, some about your sort of spiritual views. We just have like 2 minutes left, but I just was wondering if there's anything you would add now, like what have you kind of learned or working with over the last 10 years or so, where you're like, you know, there's something else I'd like to throw into that, because it's a very appealing title for the reasons we've been talking about this hour, but is there some little addendum that you have?
Well, I'm working on another book now, and I have no deadline when I'm going to finish it, but it's refining and adding a lot. I have no little simple thing, but it's going to be just a collection of stories and insights, some of which we did a little bit of today. But I will plug our website, because I'll put up the article that brought us together on yoga and psychedelics. I'll put it up on my blog today, so if people want to go to whitelotus.org, they'll be able to read that article that you enjoyed, and they can read about the book. And I think it's a book that really shows people, instead of telling them, I didn't even put pictures of asanas in it. I just put principles they can use to develop a practice their own that's tuned to themselves, so they can learn how to tune the yoga to themselves instead of following somebody else's system.
Yeah, you talk about that in one of the lines that stuck with me, how there's kind of an ambition, and then there's an attunement, and the there's a distinction between we can be very, we really want to make our posture perfect or whatever. There's this kind of goal orientation, but attunement is a different thing. It has a progression to it, but it's not goal oriented in the same way.
That's exactly right. You're learning to tune your body with the poses, instead of using your body to attain a pose you saw. And it turns out many of the postures in the yoga books come from circus contortionists, and we've discovered over time they're great for show, and they might be fun to do if you're able to comfortably do them, but long-term benefit for your body, they can overstrain your joints and ligaments. So it's more learning to just take poses and use them to tune your own well-being, physical, mental, psychological. And that, we believe, is the highest form of practice. And Yoga Beyond Belief aims to give people the tools to learn how to do that.
Wonderful. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Ganga White, thanks so much for joining me on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much.
Great. Next week, let's see, we'll be talking to John Crowley, the amazing author. Until then, keep your minds open.
Bye-bye.